Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I have the distinct pleasure of introducing to you today the Honourable David Emerson, Canadian business leader, strategist and visionary. Before I present some of the highlights of Mr. Emerson's career to date, I'd just like to take a few moments to share with you the tremendous impact that Mr. Emerson has had on Canadian trade and transportation sectors. Canada is very much a trading nation, and Mr. Emerson has been a highly effective advocate for and architect of major improvements in Canada's ability to trade internationally. As Minister of International Trade and Minister for the Pacific Gateway and the Vancouver Whistler Olympics between 2006 and 2008, Mr. Emerson was instrumental in resolving a highly public and long-standing dispute with the United States over softwood lumber exports. He was an enthusiastic supporter of port amalgamation, a groundbreaking, precedent-setting success that required legislative changes to enact. But most importantly to all of us in the broader Canadian trade and transportation industries, Mr. Emerson was one of the driving forces behind the recognition and development of Canada's Pacific Gateway. Having championed Canada's federal government to initiate new policy and create the Building Canada Fund, Mr. Emerson subsequently led the development and implementation of Canada's Asia-Pacific Gateway and Corridor Initiative, which initially committed nearly $600 million for critical infrastructure improvement to benefit ports and the whole supply chain on Canada's west coast. Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced the details of the initiative on October 11, 2006, at the Centerm Container Terminal in the heart of Port Metro Vancouver. And I'd like to just read for you a brief part of Mr. Emerson's message from October 2006. The Asia-Pacific Gateway and Corridor Initiative recognizes that Canada is a trading nation, and our ability to compete in a changing world demands a new kind of leadership. Success in international commerce today is driven by timely and efficient movement of goods and people in global supply chains. It requires new approaches from governments, and it means giving businesses the tools to adapt. This important initiative is our government's response, focused on early action, long-term direction, and most importantly, results. Our plan will advance the efficiency of the gateway as a platform for North America and better equip us to take maximum advantage of it. These immediate new investments, policies, and regulatory measures will benefit exporters and importers across the country. The vision is one of collaboration between governments and private sector leaders. The result will be a more competitive Canada long into the future. Nearly 4 years later, I'm sure you'd agree these statements still resonate clearly. One cannot help but declare that the billion-dollar Asia-Pacific Gateway has been a resounding, unqualified success for our industry and our nation. We have witnessed unprecedented government and private sector support for generational investment in infrastructure development across Canada. These benefits will continue long into the future as the infrastructure build-out continues. This alignment of industry and government goals is now a recognized business model that has drawn considerable attention from other North American gateways. In Canada, now more than ever, we are indeed well positioned as an industry to work collaboratively, to maximize our potential, and to expand our international competitiveness, just as Mr. Emerson intended. Our industry and our country owe tremendous gratitude and recognition for Mr. Emerson's vision, courage, and substantial action and legacy of achievement. On a personal note, over the period from March 2009, when I assumed leadership of Port Metro Vancouver, I've been fortunate to have had a number of opportunities to discuss the development of the Asia-Pacific Gateway with David. I found his insight invaluable and have continually been impressed by his depth of knowledge, strategic analysis, and unswerving commitment to continued improvement of Canada's trading capabilities as a key component of its economic success. Mr. Emerson has a pretty astounding resume, and in the interest of time, I'll just hit a few of the highlights. But let me share with you some of those highlights of his professional career. In 1975, Mr. Emerson joined the government of British Columbia, becoming the province's Deputy Minister of Finance. In 1986, he left the government to become President and CEO of the Western Pacific Bank of Canada, and following a merger, became Chairman and CEO of Canadian Western Bank. 4 years later, in 1990, he returned to the provincial government as Deputy Minister for Finance and then Deputy Minister to the Premier, and later President of the BC Trade Development Corporation. In 1992, Mr. Emerson was appointed to the newly created Vancouver International Airport Authority, YVR. where he established and led the airport to being one of Canada's most important international hubs for Canadian cargo and for passengers. In 1998, he was appointed president and CEO of the public-listed forestry products company, Canfor Corporation. Despite US duties and a high Canadian dollar, he managed to increase profits, raise share price, implement efficiency upgrades, increase capacity, and reduce production costs. Mr. Emerson was first elected to Canada's House of Commons in 2004 and named as Minister of Industry in July 2004. He was re-elected in 2006 and served as Minister of International Trade and Minister for the Pacific Gateway and Vancouver Whistler Olympics, and was appointed Minister of Foreign Affairs in 2008. In November 2008, he joined CAI Capital Management, a private equity firm, in the role of senior advisor. He's currently chairing the Premier's Council for Economic Strategy in Alberta, the Energy Policy Institute of Canada, and serves as a co-chair of the Prime Minister's Advisory Committee on Public Service. In addition to this, he also serves on a wide range of Canadian boards, corporate boards in Canada. His academic background was having in the University of Alberta, and he earned a doctorate in economics from Queen's University. He truly is an innovative business leader, a visionary parliamentarian, a scholar, and a great Canadian. It gives me great pleasure to present the 2010 AAPA Port Person of the Year Award to the Honourable David Emerson.
Well, good morning. I was asked to say a few words in response to receiving this tremendous honor, but let me just first say thank you so much with all my heart to the American Association of Port Authorities, because as someone who's been in politics for a portion of my life, it's not often that defunct politicians are recognized for anything except getting the heck out. So I thank you very much, and I thank Robin for the wonderful, if exhausting, introduction. And thank you also to all those people in the ports business in Canada that I've worked with over many years, in pursuit of gateway strategies and port and airport and transportation and logistical developments in general, because working with Port Metro Vancouver and the people in Prince Rupert, I should say, we've had a wonderful working relationship, and without the caliber of people in management that we've had in those ports, we certainly wouldn't have seen the successes that we have seen. Having said that, we have a long way to go. And your team here in Halifax, Karen Oldfield, what a great team of people. And you're climbing the curve, and I think you've got a tremendously impressive future in front of you. And I wish you well. Let me just say a few words about my thoughts, having been out of the transportation business for a couple of years. But let me just say that you can't, and you know this better than I do, you can't talk about ports, gateways, and corridors, strategically at least, in anything other than a 20 to 30 year time frame. And when I look back, when I first got involved in the ports and transportation and airports business, that was the late 80s, early 90s. Basically, it was a generation ago. But when you reflect on the substance of what's happened over the last 20 years, what you realize is we've been through an entire generation, and we've been through an economic revolution that I think has tremendous implications for trade and for the transportation and logistics business. You will have all had speakers that have given you specific granularity, I'm sure, on the seismic shifts that have taken place in the global economy, but you can go back to the digital age and the innovation of the container, as described in the book called The Box, and then the revolution in technology, particularly the digital revolution that has occurred over the last 20 years. And the consequences of that have been absolutely earth-shaking, which is why I call them seismic shifts, because what you have seen, and I think this is a fairly direct consequence of the technology revolution that has taken place and will continue to take place over the next 10 or 20 or 30 years, is the obliteration of the old order. You've seen developing economies that were in a state of almost complete poverty in many cases, all of a sudden have access to the kinds of tools and opportunities that developed countries like the United States and Canada have had for many, many decades. And as a result, you've seen a major shift in the economic distribution of wealth creation in the world. We all know the China story. China has basically transformed itself and its economy more in the last 30 years than any country in the history of the world. And that is a very, very profound development, and it's not completely unique to China. India is not far behind. Brazil is coming on like gangbusters. Russia's coming on. And you can go around the world in Africa, Latin America, and see many examples of countries who, given the globalization that has been basically catalyzed by technology and the digital revolution, a complete shift in the way wealth is created, in the distribution of wealth in the world, and it has, I think, some very important implications. One implication is that when you think about trade, there was a time, and I'm an academic trade economist actually in my early years, where you thought about trade as producing something in country A and shipping it to country B, and you talked about comparative advantage, and there was all kinds of cute theorems that mathematicians and economists had about trade and how it would work and what its consequences will be. But trade today is really a manifestation of the workings of value grids that are ubiquitous throughout the global economy. We used to talk about shipping from A to B, then we went to supply chains and containers got us talking supply chains and just in time. And really, if you're going to be accurate in describing the fundamental drivers of the global economy today, you got to talk about value grids. Global value grids are networks. And that means you've got production and distribution and research and people deployment all over the world. You've got value creation footprints in your major markets. There's a scramble out there for physical objects that are needed for wealth creation, like natural resources. And all of this is done in a way that optimizes value for shareholders, for companies, in a global context. And so you get products, for example, in North America, you can get products going back and forth across the border 5, 10, 20, 30 times in the process of creating something like an automobile or some other manufactured product. And so globalization has changed the nature of the game. And that means if you're in the transportation and logistics business, you've got to get yourself ahead of the curve and understand that global value grids are here to stay and they're going to become more profound, and the way you shape your business is going to have to be driven by the needs of these global value grids. And I'll say a bit more about that in a couple of moments. But I also just want to say that globalization, of course, has had this economic effect. It's also caused many, many important issues that will impact on you in your personal lives or in your professional lives to become globalized issues. the environment now is a globalized issue. We cannot effectively resolve issues relating to ecosystems and the environment and CO2 without having some kind of a global accord to deal with the issue. Poverty and distribution of wealth has become a global issue. Everyone can see the economic condition and the health condition of everybody else. And so all of these issues, security, communications, have all become fundamental global issues. And so globalization has really rewritten the rules of the game. And indeed, many of the institutions that we've set up over the years, the World Trade Organization, the United Nations, these institutions are now faltering because globalization has changed so much that finding ways to make consensus decisions internationally is falling on hard times because you're seeing major splits between the emerging economies and the advanced developed economies. And so things have changed in a fundamental way, and we have not seen the end of it, not even close. So we need to keep thinking about it. But I want to talk about another piece that's changed in a way that is unfortunate, and that is what I call the North American platform. In the early 90s, as you know, Canada, the United States, and Mexico forged a free trade agreement called NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement. And as a result of NAFTA, our three countries have seen major improvements in our levels of competitiveness, our efficiency, our productivity, and our ability to create wealth and jobs in North America. The North American platform, in my view, is the North American worker's very best friend, and yet it has been maligned, and it is politically unpopular in the U.S., probably, Mexico. It is not unpopular in Canada, thank goodness. But NAFTA and the economic integration and the platform for wealth creation that NAFTA has allowed us to develop is, in fact, what enables North American industry to compete against the Chinese, against the Indians, against the Vietnamese, against those hyper-competitive emerging economies that I talked about. But over the last 10 years or so, NAFTA has been eroding. There's been protectionist measures of almost all descriptions and colors, from country of origin labeling to Buy America to so-called environmental initiatives that are turning into trade protectionist initiatives. We've had an enormous proliferation of border issues, not the least of which has been the security issues at the border that have been a fallout from 9/11. And so in North America, the very tool, the very common asset that we have had that has given us a tremendous advantage in terms of global competitiveness is now becoming badly eroded. And I think it's time for a wake-up call in terms of getting North Americans, the three partners in North America, and eventually expanding that into the Americas, is absolutely critical as we go forward and start taking on hyper-competitive economies in the world. If we do not do that, they're going to steamroll over us, and we will keep reacting negatively and with protectionist measures that will be destructive for our ability to earn wealth and enhance our standard of living going forward. So what has all this got to do with ports and gateways and corridors? The reality is transportation and logistics and the ports, the corridors, and the gateways that connect North America with the world are, in fact, the transportation and logistics backbone of the North American platform. And what I believe is absolutely critically important is that port authorities, airport authorities, trucking companies, railways, all need to recognize in a very, very fundamental, strategic, and disciplined way that we have a community of interest in building and rebuilding and energizing the North American platform. And that means, and to some degree, when I was in government, that was the thinking that we had in Canada. We looked at the Asia-Pacific Gateways and Corridors initiatives not as a gateway between Asia, Asia-Pacific, and Canada. We looked at it as a gateway between Asia and North America. And, you know, frankly, Canada is just a small fish with a population less than California and a landmass second only to Russia. And so for Canada, we have to be part of a larger economic unit. And our Gateway and Corridor Initiative was all about that. And what I am saying, and I will continue to say now, is that if we do not stop the erosion of the North American platform, if we do not get back to working collaboratively to make sure governments, whether it's regulatory or optimizing infrastructure, or a host of other technology investments, if we do not get back to the reintegration and re-energization of the North American platform, we're going to have a problem. Because the Achilles heel of the North American platform, the Achilles heel of North American competitiveness, is the border. And I'm talking primarily the national borders, but as you all know, because you're so used to NIMBYism, you can get down to borders around municipalities, you can get down to province and state borders. We've got to eradicate as much as we possibly can, as quickly as we possibly can, the kinks and discontinuities that are disrupting our value grid within North America and ultimately within the Americas. I just intuitively leap to some of the priorities that we need to think about. And clearly, we need to re-energize NAFTA as job one. And I think port authorities and people involved in transportation and logistics really do have to, in a focused and disciplined way, put their shoulder to the wheel to get politicians and the general public to understand the need for a stronger, more integrated North American economic space. So that's job one. Job two, in my view, and this is a bit radical and may never be done, I really think we need to continue to pressure governments to do something they don't want to do, but they really should do in the public interest, and that is to start to designate strategic transportation and logistics corridors within countries, within provinces, and even transborder corridors, because what we see so much of, and it's a constant cancer that undermines our ability to build the transportation and logistics sector is you're getting municipalities that will put subdivisions under flight paths that they know are there, they know are going to be noisy. We try to put a good expedited rail system through, and communities all want expensive build-arounds and increasingly expensive investments in noise and other kinds of disturbance mitigation measures. And so I believe that we really do need, as quickly as possible, governments to begin to designate super corridors that really are immune to these kinds of intrusions on the development of an efficient transportation and logistics corridor. And it would be better for neighborhoods, better for the environment if we did that. Thirdly, obviously, strategic infrastructure. We have to continue to invest in strategic infrastructure, but we also need to optimize its use. We're in the ports business, but you got to extend your thinking to transportation of electrons, transportation of fuels, carbon fuels. We need to optimize our transportation infrastructure grids within North America again. The amount of environmental excess damage that is created by a suboptimum infrastructure configuration, nobody ever measures that. But I can tell you, if they ever did, and if they ever did it correctly, the consequences would be enormous. And so we need to be optimizing infrastructure across borders. You will all have heard, again, about another shock that's coming, and it's actually not far away, and that's the Panama shock. We need to get ahead of that and understand what the consequences are. They're certainly not all bad, but for some ports that sit back and wait for it to hit, it could be it could have negative consequences. And I think we also need, and the gentleman that was from the Great Lakes Authority commented on the shipping on the Great Lakes and through the Seaway and the seasonality of it. We're going to see the Northwest Passage open for shipping in the next 10 years. And we need to understand what the implications of that are. Yeah, it'll probably be seasonal, and yeah, it'll maybe have very particular applications and uses, but we need to be thinking collectively and deeply about what the prospects and implications of the opening up of the Northwest Passage are, because when it does open, it will provide for a very new form of competition. And if you add to that what I think is going to be a great bow wave of wealth creation in North America going forward, which is natural resources development, you've got a whole other issue coming up, which is the issues around transportation and shipment of natural resource products. That's coming, and it's something that we need to be thinking a great deal about, because natural resources are bountiful in Canada, to some degree in the United States, and we're going to see an awful lot more wealth creation coming out of natural resources, and we're going to have to think about the transportation and logistics dimensions of that issue. And I guess finally, our environmental footprint. Environmental sensitivities and concerns aren't going away. We're going to have to focus on that. We're going to have to think about that whenever we're thinking about capital stock turnover and how we develop our business in the long haul. The last thing that this industry needs, in my opinion, is kind of draconian regulatory demands from governments who are not sensitive to how the business actually works and can create all manner of issues for you. So that is my call to you folks. It's let's build the North American platform. We can only do it through collaboration. We need to integrate transportation and logistics cross borders. We need to operate and recognize that the North American platform is a common asset of three countries, and we need to work together to develop it. And I would say that your association and your members can be a driving force in getting people and governments to understand how critical that is going forward. So let's get on with it. I'm 65 now. I've got a few more years, and I'll be out there making my voice heard. So thank you for your recognition of my past work, and I really appreciate it. Hope you're having a great conference.
I think that concludes the morning session, and next is lunch at the Westin, if I'm right. Excellent. And it's in the hall here. Lunch is here. Lunch is in the exhibit hall. Sorry, right, I'm wrong. There we go. Lunch next door.